Welcome back to episode 2, season 2 of Let's Talk Security Testing, the podcast where we talk about all things security testing. Today, we are covering what can security testing learn from quality control? This has been a quite widely debated topic, I guess, going back and forward really between kind of quality does things that security don't, and there's lots security can learn, and probably vice versa. I mean, what's your general synopsis of the debate and how much of it is really valuable?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing to separate the two out to begin with, right? Because there's a strong argument that security is just another quality measure, right? You write bad code that in that it's got lots of vulnerabilities, that is a quality problem as much as it is a security problem. So I don't like to separate the two out, but what I do recognise and what I do think is important is acknowledging the fact that quality control has been around longer than security has been around. They have learned the hard lessons. They're probably more important to most organisations. You know, it's the thing that gets discussed in the boardrooms. So there certainly is a lot of respect that we in security have to play to quality control, and we really have to be having the conversations with the people who work in there. I guess, how do we go about doing that, though? You know, how would we engage in those conversations, and what is quality control when we're not just talking about security?
I think a lot. I mean, we think we can learn from businesses that have already started doing it. I mean, I certainly see now more often than I used to that, you know, you have kind of dual security and quality titles, particularly in businesses that are software development focused. I think that's a massive positive for kind of where we're getting to as an industry, particularly where, you know, if the business focuses on software development, quality and security go a lot more hand in hand for the examples that you've just spoken about. I think predominantly, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but for me, a lot of quality comes from processes, and processes being performed and executed correctly. You know, we talk a lot in security about kind of guardrails and paved roads and all these sorts of fancy buzzwords. But in reality, I mean, we are talking about effective processes that enable or just naturally lead us to a better quality outcome than we would have got to without them processes.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing we have to acknowledge in security is that we seem to be, I don't want to say lackadaisical, but we seem to be accepting that a lot of what we're doing is we'll try and do our best, but we're, you know, if we miss the odd thing, if we don't quite catch things too soon, we catch them eventually, that's good enough. I think quality control and the gates that they've been able to introduce to prevent, you know, even simple things like typos in the copy ending up in production. You know, how often is it that you see those kinds of things? It's very, very rarely you end up seeing any of that kind of stuff get into production. I think we have to acknowledge the fact that they are doing something right in order to prevent those things. And that is introducing those gates in an effective way and having the entire business respect those from development through to project management and delivery that prevents these issues. Maybe what quality is doing better than security is actually engaging other stakeholders in the business. Is that something that you've seen?
I think so. I think that it helps, you know, that it's a function, I guess, with a more specific purpose. Security can often get blurred between so many different disciplines and areas. You know, take a look at the NIST framework and start breaking that down, and you realize how, you know, vast security is on the whole. Whereas, I guess, you know, to some extent, quality can be a bit more refined. But I think largely it's a communication thing, and it's a kind of a purpose and vision thing, a focus that allows it to become what it is. That being said, though, quality is not perfect either, and it's you know, different businesses have different systems and approaches. You know, particularly if you look at kind of the agile, you know, 2010 onwards businesses, that have kind of incurred more technical debt, have pushed harder. They're certainly kind of, their quality and their security are kind of in the same place, right? You know, where you have a big vulnerability backlog, you also have a big, you know, functional backlog, potentially quite a high amount of technical debt. These, I guess, are sorts of things go hand in hand. So it'd be interesting to know whether there is a correlation between kind of poor quality elsewhere and poor security. But certainly if you're seeing great quality but poor security, then clearly there's something that the people running quality are doing that security need to kind of learn from, feed into, whatever it might be.
Just thinking about our own software development experience, and I think one of the reasons why quality is successful and security isn't, beyond their maturity and experience and process, is that it's maybe easier for everybody to get, in some instances, for developers, for example, to get. It's really, really easy to understand as a developer how you can have pride in your work if you've produced something that's considered to be good quality. It works, it doesn't look buggy, you know, it's pretty well designed, well structured, there's not errors all over the place. You know, it is a nice, valuable piece of work. And they can also imagine how, if it wasn't that, that would have an adverse impact to the business. You know, it's easy to see how if somebody logs onto something and the buttons all look a bit wonky, that's going to drive people away from the site. Whereas when we talk about security and security vulnerabilities particularly, I think while it's easy to understand that there is the potential for these vulnerabilities to be exploited, actually imagining this will happen to us, you know, actually imagining that somebody will find this complex vulnerability somewhere deep inside the system and that there are people targeting it and that the compromise of that is going to have a detrimental impact to the business is maybe harder. Do you think, is that a fair assessment?
I mean, that's the exact reason why we can't just give security to quality, right? Again, I've seen countless examples of where quality control own an element of security within their work, and I'm yet to find anyone say that it's effective in any way, shape or form because of the nuance around security. And because, yeah, I'm doing a review, whether the QA is a manual review of the code or a functional test in production, you know, certainly when they've done the when I hear of the manual review of the code line by line, from a QA perspective, security vulnerabilities get missed incredibly frequently. But this is just the skill set. Going back to what you said in the earlier podcasts, you know, low-hanging fruit are much easier to find than more complex vulnerabilities. You almost have to have an adversarial head on to say, how can I manipulate this to be able to find certain business logic flaws that to anybody else would just seem like good usability. You know, so many vulnerabilities are actually just really good usability. And as long as you're not trying to abuse them, they're actually quite convenient vulnerabilities to exist. It's only when, you know, we had an example, didn't we? I think it was a couple of years ago now. And it was with a banking system that we were using. And effectively, it allowed me to pivot between my accounts and see various statements in a way that I wasn't supposed to be able to. It was quite convenient for me. Like, it was really good. But then when I discussed it with you, it was immediately, it's definitely a vulnerability, because if you were this person and that was that person, then you'd be able to see this. And obviously we reported it through the normal channels. But I guess this is the challenge, right? A QA person, it's a good feature, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, those are the differences between security and quality control. What are the things that we can learn? Like, what are quality control getting right that is applicable to security? I think that's the more interesting question.
Yeah, 100%. And I think going back to what I said earlier, I think there's a lot to learn from their, not just their processes, but how they get those processes in. Right, because I speak to a lot of security people, and it's not that they haven't got the ideas. It's not that they don't know what the processes are. It's how we get buy-in, you know, and I guess not just buy-in, but actual adoption as well. Because you've got several hurdles to get through. If you're a security manager, and I'm sure there's plenty listening, you know, it's not just a case of, you know, you have that first meeting with a vendor, or you have that first meeting internally about in the security team about implementing a gate or a stage or a process. Great. There's so many hurdles through to full adoption, right? Beyond kind of bringing in the necessary tool sets, getting executive buy-in, rolling out the training, tracking the getting the valuable metrics back, tracking the valuable metrics back, improving upon them. Like, you know, these are all really kind of quite hard things to get done, especially when you've got kind of, even just within software development security alone, you've got several of these things inside, you know, stage one or two of the DevSecOps maturity model. Like, so I guess I think it's as much about learning about how they've got some of these processes implemented inside that organization, and going back to your communication point earlier, as it is about the learning from the processes themselves. One way people do it is piggybacking into the existing processes that are already in place, right? And going, okay, well, that's already there. But that's not always preferable, right? If there are ways to get your more preferable setup done in the same, but you just have to do it in the same way that they've got their preferable setup in, which is, you know, by learning from them and learning from how they did it.
I think that's fair, but I definitely do think there are technical measures that QA have in place that security can immediately piggyback into. I'm not necessarily saying this is the long-term fix to sort all of security's problems, but there are things like, for example, in pretty much every organization that does sprinted releases, you will have a week of development, a week of UAT, a week of QA, and then you will have release or something of that nature inside the SDLC. That week of UAT, people going through, clicking the buttons, checking that they are satisfied with the outcome of the development work, should also be a week in which security people are clicking those buttons, reviewing them, identifying whether or not those form fields take characters that they're not supposed to or anything of that nature, right? It's a really, really simple opportunity for testing an application inside the development sprint, and those QA people, functional testers, are being informed about the changes that are being made and using that in order to make a determination about what, when, and how to test. Security could very, very easily read those exact same test scripts and start inferring from that what, when, and how to security test.
No, I'm with you. I think it makes complete sense. And I think where you've got these kind of existing windows, the only challenge, I guess, you'll have is that some of these QA testing teams and some of the resources that they have, they can be quite sizable functions if they're either internal or they're outsourced potentially as well. Often they're offshore as well, so they've kind of reducing the cost that way. I guess there are those barriers in that you might have a security team of three people. You couldn't possibly jump into every single UAT window and do all of that testing. What would you say are the key ways in which maybe you could drive some focus or try and find areas where, you know, we could piggyback off them processes and see value without necessarily having to have a team that equates to the size of the QA function?
Well, I guess you could really refine which areas that you're supposed to be testing by saying, do I already have a gate in place to be able to find a bunch of the vulnerabilities that otherwise I'd be testing for? You know, do I have SAST that can probably find the majority of low sophistication injection attacks, and so I don't need to manually test for those. And therefore, all I really need to be focusing on is not just this form field, not just clicking on this because this was the thing that's changed and this is the thing that the functional test is looking at, but look at this form field for sophisticated injection attacks, for business logic flaws, for those things that SAST or DAST or whatever my pre-existing gates are not already looking for. You know, at that point you're looking at like a pen tester not spending days or weeks testing all of the features, but 45 minutes, an hour and a half, maybe two at most, really, really just focusing on those hypercritical areas inside the application for those critical vulnerabilities that have not already been looked at.
Yeah, and again, one of the biggest advantages we have in security here over QA is, realistically, if I showed you a sprint release description that gave you an insight into all of the things that have changed during this release window and what this UAT window is going to help you to look at, and we were talking about this from a QA functionality usability perspective, you know, there's not an awful lot you can get from that that allows you to cut down the QA time, right? If you mess with this button could be broken. If you've done this, it could be broken, mate. And, you know, there's many, many, many different checklists that you have to follow to make sure these things haven't been implemented. With security, that's not really the case, right? We are, by looking at a release document that says this is what is effectively changing, from that, you will be able to curate a much more refined methodology than you would have otherwise had to follow. So I guess, to some extent, is that an advantage that we have in security over QA, that we, whilst we can borrow some of their things, we can actually perform the task in a slightly more efficient way?
I don't necessarily know that's true. I think QA has that opportunity too. You know, they've got E2E tests, they've got unit tests, they've got mechanisms to be able to automate a lot of the same things in the ways that we do. What they perhaps have less of is pre-configured tools to be able to do that. They actually have to write their own tests for a lot of these. You can do the same thing in security though, right? You can actually write smoke tests that say, as user A, can I access user B's endpoint? As user B, can I do an administrative function even though I'm not an administrative user? Those are the kinds of things that you get functional tests in order to assess, and you can quite easily get security tests in order to assess as well. So no, I don't think that we're necessarily at an advantage outside of the fact that some of our tools come pre-configured. But I do think that it is very much true that automation and the capability for automation inside that process is something that UAT is having to leverage, and something that security is already aware exists, but could certainly leverage a lot more. But obviously, we've spoken about technical controls that QA people have that we could learn from. We've spoken about strategic controls or strategic processes that QA testers have been shown to be good at that we could learn from. What about output? You know, what about what the way that the information, once it's been captured, is actually fed back into the business? If you find a QA problem, I would assume that those get fixed a lot sooner, those get treated a lot more seriously. But what is it that they're doing right that security maybe isn't?
I think this is where you end up with the difference between kind of what's the definition of kind of code working and what's the tolerance of the business, right? Often what I suspect what QA is finding are things that would prevent the release from doing what it's supposed to do, things that make the release actually worse than it was before it was out from a customer's perspective. People don't see vulnerabilities, right? They don't affect the way that you use a system. They don't affect kind of the way a system looks and feels. So I suspect QA have a greater capacity to fail a release for that reason, that there's kind of no point releasing something if the customer or the user is going to sort of, you know, report a worse experience than they had before it. Whereas with security vulnerabilities, it's much more of a risk question, right? It's much more a question of, well, we know the user is going to have a better experience using the system after we make this release. The problem is the risk is higher. That's possibly a completely different team, possibly a completely different vision. To your point before about the boardroom, a completely different voice in the boardroom. Not that a conversation about a release going out is done at the board level, but that is systemic and carries its way down through the business. So I think that probably has a part to play, and it's very organisation dependent in terms of where security sits. You know, I literally just come off a conversation this morning of a security person that works for the IT team that works underneath the director of software development. So security is sat, security which owns software development security is sat underneath IT, which is sat underneath software development. So you can understand how maybe some of the hierarchical conversations go when someone that works for the IT team is skipping three line managers to have a conversation about software development security, right? So I guess to some extent, these will be some of the challenges.
See, I find it really interesting that you don't consider maybe I'm putting words in your mouth here, but you don't consider the issues found in QA to be the same risk conversation as the issues found in security. Like, when we're talking about assessing whether or not to fix a typo or fix a colour scheme issue or something like that, it is still a risk conversation, right? It's a conversation about whether we're risking our reputation, our brand, our user engagement, their overall experience. Mm-hmm. These are still risk conversations. They're just perhaps more tangible to every person in the business. If I start talking about, you know, an insecure direct object reference inside an application, then it's really hard to engage somebody in the conversation about understanding why that is a problem. Mm. But if I start talking to somebody about how the log out button on the website doesn't work and spits out a bunch of different errors to the user, then it's much, much easier for everybody to really get on board with why that is a risk.
Yeah, no, I do agree with you. I disagree with you that principally it is a risk-based conversation that's happening within the business. Yes, there's middle ground to be found along the term of risk, but I think generally speaking, it's like more of a practical conversation around the bug itself. Whether it is is it worth making the release or not based on the overall value? But if users are going to find a worse experience after making the release, it's obviously worth fixing those things beforehand. Whereas I find with security, there's very rarely ever going to be a conversation when if you've made, you know, unless the release is literally a security update, in which case introducing new vulnerabilities seems counterintuitive in a security update, you're nearly always going to have practical new things that are going to be on the system that's going to benefit users being held up by an invisible risk that has nothing to do with users. And so often we talk about kind of user-focused businesses, you know, the customer is always right, goes back, like, I don't know, 70s to 60s or whatever. Like, you're right, I don't disagree with you, but I think what you were hinting at is what I do agree with also, which is that it's very difficult to put vulnerabilities on a level playing field with tangible bugs when it comes to communicating the risk to the business.
Yeah, I think yeah, it's definitely easier to get buy-in when people don't tune out or when everybody understands it straight away. And that's definitely something we as security people have been working on in the last few years, is trying to find a way to be able to communicate information in a way that is engaging and people get without having to upskill.
I think likelihood's another one, though. Like, we talk about likelihood a lot when we're risk scoring things, right? Like, in your head, realistically, when you've got 10,000 users actively using a system, likelihood of this bug being found is quite high because people are clicking on it every single day. If you've got an insecure direct object reference, the fallacy that everyone thinks is, well, you know, yeah, sure, if someone knew where it was and knew how to find it and was looking that day, likelihood is high, and security people will put likelihood as high for that reason. But what we don't factor into our likelihood ratings really is the fact that if no one's looking for it, if no one knows exactly where it is, if no one's actively trying to hack into this application, the likelihood of them actually finding it isn't as high. And I can see how people will say, well, actually, you know, that can just be fixed when it's fixed, rather than it having to kind of block the release in the same way, something that is inevitably, definitely going to cause a problem in the next 2 or 3 weeks goes out the door anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think in both instances, obviously, at its most simple form, the risk calculation can be boiled down to being impact times probability, or impact times likelihood. And in quality instances, impact is fairly easy to understand. You can understand what the impact of not being able to click a button is, and probability can be easily calculated using readily available information inside a business. You know how many users you have, you know how many of them go to that page and try and perform that action, so you can very easily calculate the risk. When we're talking about vulnerabilities, impact is something that can readily be understood by a lot of people, but likelihood is incredibly hard to provide any sort of tangible data on. You might have deep threat intelligence, you might have all sorts of means of being able to try and derive a probability number from it, but you're never going to have the same level of confidence, and therefore that overall risk is a bit more of a sort of finger-in-the-air ephemeral thing than you're ever going to get with QA.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think that's been a really, really good debate. I think lots to learn, lots to take away. What would you say is the main thing people could take away from today's podcast?
Engage stakeholders. That's probably going to be the most important, whether you're in quality assurance or whether you're in security. There may be processes that you can already piggyback off of or learn from, and find ways to communicate to your audience in a way that they understand without necessarily expecting them to upskill, which are all things that we've seen quality assurance do really, really well, and all things I think security has the opportunity to do too.
Yeah, and don't just learn the processes. Like, learn how they got the processes through. Mm-hmm. Because these sorts of things are very, very organisation dependent, and, you know, people get things done in all sorts of ways. So I think learning about your organisation specifically, especially if you're new into a business, asking people, you know, how did you get that done? You know, what did you have to do to get that done? You know, who did you speak to? What levers did you pull? What did the business case look like? These sorts of questions, you know, these people might have the answers that you're looking for, which could take 2-3 years off implementing a particular process or policy in your tenure at that organization. But thank you for listening. Thank you for taking the time. We'll be back next week with another episode of Let's Talk Security Testing. But for now, bye now.
Bye now.